So we'll start that again from where you start from the top, Andrew. Thank you, folks. Thank you. Okay, Andrew, please continue.
Okay, well, yeah. So you asked me how I got started in these sort of areas, and I basically sort of said that it was really due to a reinvestigation of the so-called Reynolds and Forrest incident, which happened in 1980, sometimes called the Bentwaters Base, and it involved a landing of a craft in Reynolds and Forrest. And there was a documentary which aired on BBC television. It was called Britain's Closest Encounter. And that was in 2003. I think it was like April 2003, sometime like that. And that caused me to sort of go online. I just got broadband by then. And that allowed me then to reinvestigate this incident, find a lot more information, and I realized there was a whole lot more stuff that you could basically click onto and download videos and stuff like that. And then I think one of the next things that I found out about was the 9/11 issue. And by then, the Ari May Sand book had come out, and I came across discussion of that, although I didn't read that book at that time. That book was called Hunt the Boeing, and it was primarily about the Pentagon crash. So it was a few websites that I started to look at then, which really made me start to question various areas. And I mean, one other thing I will add to that part of the discussion is, prior to that, you know, even when I got my first dial-up connections, I was looking at information on what's called cold fusion, which is an energy phenomenon, and that was one of the first things I started to try and find out information about back in probably 1997, when I was on dial-up internet then. So, and I realized there was quite a bit of information about that, which I wasn't aware of before then. So, it all kind of followed a kind of path, really.
Yeah. And then the main thing was 9/11.
Well, that kind of became one of the central areas for my research, yes. That started to happen, I think, probably going on from about 2006, because between 2003 and 2006, I was more focused on finding out more about the UFO issue, and learned about Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project. But later on, I was to find that there were significant connections between these areas, which, you know, I didn't really anticipate at first, but then gradually I realised that this wasn't as crazy as it might initially sound, that there would be this sort of connection, and that was primarily because of the energy issue, really. That's the connecting issue between many of these threads, you know, and I would have hoped I discussed that at the 9/11 presentation in Penzance that you said you came along to, because it's a very big part of the picture, which only a small number of people will actually talk about in relation to 9/11. They don't even, they don't even talk about energy issues for the most part. Most of the main well-funded, well-designed 9/11 websites don't even touch on the energy issue at all, and that is not that's deliberate. That's not because they don't know about it.
No,
or people behind these websites don't know about it. It's because they're actually part of a large-scale cover-up of its own, and that was another theme that I really discovered in that. You know, in many, if not all, of these areas of alternative knowledge, energy, banking, health, 9/11, Kennedy assassination, UFOs and aliens, in all of these areas, there are at least two levels of cover-up. There's the official story, and then there is an official conspiracy theory, if you like, or an official sort of narrative, alternative narrative, you might call it. And both of those, both the official narrative and the alternative official narrative, if you want to call it that, are false. And what tends to happen is that the two people end up in the two larger groups, as in they end up in the official camp for whatever issue it is, or they end up in the official alternative camp.
Yeah.
And so most of the argument goes on between those two groups, while much of the truth is only found by those who are working in a certain kind of way, with, you know, keeping their own brain and their own thinking at the forefront and not being, you know, guided too much or influenced too much by those that are forming groups and, you know, asking for money, often, not always, and that sort of thing. So that was really what I found out by about 2007. So after about 4 years of research, I realized that there was, you know, some of these truth seekers and truth speakers were not telling you the truth at all. They actually had their own agenda. And I've now written two books, you know, covering that sort of material and why I know that that's true, you know.
Yeah. When I was at your talk, Andrew, the thing that really hit me was that right at the end of the first half, just before we took the interval, you said they were not planes, they were holograms. And I went, yes.
I may not have used those exact words because I'm sort of some fairly choosy with my, you know, words in that area, but that's almost certainly what I implied.
Yeah.
Because that really, when you study the evidence, and this is, you know, this is an example going back to what I was saying, you know, a couple of minutes ago. The official story of 9/11 is that, you know, Muslim hijackers, you know, crashed planes into the World Trade Center. And I believed that story for at least 18 months, you know, after the events, and didn't really question it.
Yeah.
And then you start to get into the internet conspiracy issues, and they will, you'll say, you know, you hear people say it was remote control planes. Or it was maybe CGI planes. In other words, there weren't any real planes. What they did was all the news videos that they showed were actually, you know, had CGI graphics inserted into the videos. Okay. To give this idea that, you know, the plane crashes didn't actually happen, and therefore there were no planes at all. And again, those two extremes are both wrong. And I believe the CGI explanation for a while, but then, you know, by about sort of 2012, I'd realized that most of the CGI explanation was false. And this also fitted into a pattern of a larger cover-up as well, which maybe we'll talk about a bit later. So the idea is to explain that to people who are not familiar with this, is that the basic thing you need to do if you're interested in this is go and look at the plane crash videos from the World Trade Center. And we're primarily talking about the videos of Flight 175, which was the second plane. And that, you know, there are, I think, about 50 different videos of that, I think, some of which are very, you know, a long way from the towers and quite shaky or very brief. But I think there are about 26 good quality videos. But if you look at those videos, without exception, they show impossible physics for the plane crashes. And what I mean by that is that if you, something a little bit more familiar than a plane crash that, you know, you might have seen on TV, such as a Formula One car crash, you know, or something equivalent to that.
Yes.
High-speed rally crash or something like that. You know, you see a car, Formula One car, you know, high-speed rally car, crashing into a bank or crashing into a tree or crashing into the side of a track. You know, you'll see the car kind of bounces off whatever it hits, and bits will typically break off and fly in different directions. You know, a Formula One car, for example, is designed such that the central part where the driver is extremely strong, and so all the other parts around that will typically break off and fly around. So, you know, you'll see wheel going one way, and you know the wing at the back, or the aileron, or whatever they call it on a Formula One car, will fly off in one direction, and you know the wheel in another, and so forth. But if you go and look at the videos of the second plane crash, you will see that the plane, no bits of the plane break off, no large pieces break off, no, the tail doesn't break off, the fuselage doesn't break off, the part of the nose cone doesn't break off. It's essentially as if a hole opens up in the building,
it's and like
the plane
a cartoon.
Flies into the hole.
Yeah, it seemed to me like a cartoon, Andrew.
That's one way of looking at it, cartoon physics, yeah.
Yeah, it just didn't make any sense. Why is this plane hitting the building? Then the nose comes out the other side. I mean, you know, and as you see it cut through into the building, these wings cut through as well. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous. But no one notices. We certainly didn't notice this until people started asking questions.
Very few people, you know, as you say, very few people ask questions. And I didn't start asking questions until 2003. So, you know, so
and I was for many a lot people, longer than that.
Many years.
Yeah.
After that. But, you know, so the other, just to add a little bit to that, we won't go on about that all night because we could. But just to add a little bit to that, the other problem with the plane crash at the World Trade Center is the speed. Now the official reports claim that the 757 plane was travelling at I think 560 miles an hour.
Yeah,
which is, you know, near to the top speed of the plane. Now people might think, oh well, you know, that's, you just push the throttle forwards and no problem. That's not actually the case, because the Boeing plane can only travel at that speed when it's above, you know, when it's above most of the atmosphere, which is, you know, sort of 25, 30,000, 35,000 feet and above that, yeah, where there's not much air, the air is much thinner.
Yeah.
And that's when it will reach its top speed. But if you try and travel at 500 miles an hour at 700 feet above sea level, which was the height of the alleged impact of this plane, the plane would shake itself to pieces, you know, if it was flying at that speed. So you couldn't do it. So there are two basic problems of physics with the plane crashes, and I mean, we haven't even started talking about the building, what happened to the building and stuff. But that really, for anybody that's not familiar with this, should be a starting point for you to go and look. And this is something that you can look at yourself. You don't need to believe what I'm saying. You know, you can go and look at all the CNN and ABC news videos and the BBC news videos and so on, and they all show the same thing, as do the videos that were shot by people in the street. And this is, you know, again a bit of a problem for these people who claim it was CGI, because there were people in the street who filmed the video. So the claim is that the CGI versions of these videos were also generated, you know, in very quick succession, as it were. And and it is true that many of the civilian videos were bought by the news networks, if not all of them, so that they could use them. But that wasn't for the reason of putting computer graphics into them. And I think what we actually saw, if you look at certain pieces of evidence, is we saw some type of image projection technology at work. In other words, there was some quite sophisticated system which allowed the projection of a 3D image in the sky. And this sounds crazy, but it's, again, when you start to look at things like stealth technologies and other lines of research, which I became a little bit more familiar with later on, you realise that there is quite a lot of stuff that's been done which nobody knows about. And that is certainly true in relation to how the buildings were destroyed. The mechanism by which the buildings were destroyed is a directed energy weapon. That's not a theory for anybody that thinks it's a theory. That is what actually happened. It's not a belief, it's not a thesis, it's not a hypothesis. That's actually what happened. And the actual absence of the buildings and them being absent in the way that they were proves that a technology exists to do that. And it also proves that that technology is being covered up, because there is no information at all about that technology in the white world. There is nothing on it on Wikipedia. There's nothing in Encyclopedia Britannica. There is no shred of information about that technology in the white world, you know, that you could use from a public, you know, information source on a university website or a reputable information website such as Britannica.com, not Wikipedia. That's not reputable because that's run by interests, you know, that keep these things covered up and edit any attempts to, you know, put information about what I've just told you onto their website.
The other thing I noticed as well was when the planes were being filmed by the public, it was really strange that you couldn't hear the plane until it was sort of overhead. Surely they would have heard that plane coming in, Andrew.
Well, that's another interesting question you raised there, Graham, because I actually did a little bit of research on that back in 2007. If you go onto my website, which is checktheevidence.com, and anybody that's listening, you know, either live or on the recording, I encourage them to contact me and ask me any questions, you know, or for further information that they can't find, you know, or any references or anything. I'm quite happy to give people that. You can go onto the checktheevidence.com and you can click the contact button and fill that in and read the information there first. And or you can just use the search function on my website. But I wrote this article called Going in Search of Planes in New York City. And this is where this idea of the sound of the planes, you know, really starts to become a bit more interesting, because I did keyword searches in 500 witness accounts that were available from the New York Times website, which were released in, I think, 2006 through a Freedom of Information request, actually. And these witnesses, they were called the 9/11 Oral Histories taken by the New York Times, and they were written down over a period, I think, of about 2 years, and they spoke to emergency medical technicians, EMTs. They spoke to firefighters, and I don't think the police were allowed to take part for some reason, so I think it was mainly those two groups. And you can download all of their accounts either from my website or from the New York Times website. So again, this isn't theory, this is not a belief, this is what people actually said. And I found out that only about 20% of the witnesses that I worked out were at or near the World Trade Center, and within, at or near, I mean, either inside the building or within half a mile. Because what I did was I looked at their accounts, looked for them to say, oh, well, I was on Church Street, or I was on Vesey Street, or I was on Broadway, West Broadway. And you can look on the map and then work out just exactly where they were in relation to the World Trade Center when they give their account. Any accounts that didn't say that weren't included. So I knew, you know, from where they were that's, you know, they should have heard the plane, as you said.
Yeah.
But only about 20% of this 117 witnesses, only 20% heard the plane, and only 8% of the 117 that I found that were at or near the World Trade Center, heard and saw the plane at the same time. So it's a smaller percentage than you would expect for something which was allegedly, you know, an enormous jumbo jet plane, louder than rock concert at that sort of height, coming in at full throttle into the World Trade Center. And this is, a real problem for those that want to believe the official story. And so that really, you know, was basically pretty conclusive evidence to me.
Yeah.
That there was no real plane crashing in the way that they claimed. It was some other thing that was done.
Yeah, I mean, if you've gone into this in real depth, Andrew, but looking at it myself now, seeing, I think there's one video where a wing actually disappears from behind a building. And then there was
that's actually part of the what I call the alternative cover-up. This is one thing that some people will claim, people such as Marcus Allen, Ace Baker, I think, has claimed this at one point, and a couple of others claim that this wing apparently goes behind the building.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, that proves that the video is fake, because that building is in the wrong, they claim that this wing should be in front of the building.
Yes.
But when you actually look at that building, and Mark Conlon has done an excellent study of this, and you go onto Google Maps and you look at the 3D positioning, you find out that actually there's nothing wrong with that wing disappearing behind a building. That's actually how it should be. But what they've tried to do is they've actually tried to claim that this is proof of CGI, so that they can claim it's a fake video, and not that it's some type of hologram or image projection, which is what it actually is. Because they need, the point being, why people might be saying, well, why are they doing this, Andrew? Why? Who cares whether it's video fakery or hijackers or, you know, holograms? Why is that, you know, even important for me to know about? Well, it's important for you to know about because it's to do with technology, and it's someone's technology. Somebody has technology to project images in the sky which look real, all right?
Yeah.
And this is much more, this is way more advanced than, you know, computer-generated models, which we all see in Hollywood movies and don't even think about anymore now because they are so realistic, you know, and they can make superhero films. They don't need to make cartoons anymore. They can just make them look photorealistic, you know, as everyone knows now. So everyone knows about that. What people don't know about is military industrial complex black technology. That's what I'm talking about, and that's what people need to find out about as much as they can from the events of 9/11 and other things.
Andrew, do you think this is Tesla technology maybe that they've taken and used?
Well, one can attach that label to it without too much difficulty, because again, if people were to read Dr. Judy Wood's book, Where Did the Towers Go?, which isn't really about the plane crashes so much. There is a little bit about the plane crashes, but it's primarily about the disappearance of the buildings. She actually goes through the evidence, which leads you, you know, to the conclusion that the work of Nikola Tesla in the 1900s, the early 1900s, up until, you know, his death, that has a bearing on the technology that was developed to destroy the World Trade Center. And we're talking really, you know, Tesla was very well known for creating these coils which could generate millions of volts using a special technique that he developed. And, you know, that is the derivative of that technology, which is basically using high voltages and resonant frequencies within a static field. It's that sort of technology which was employed as part of the weapon system. So although it wasn't just a Tesla beam weapon or death ray, as some might want to call it, because that's indeed what it was called in the 1940s, we really feel quite uncomfortable with that part of the label, because we've come to know that the technology does have certain principles on which it operates, and we can essentially, by analogy, demonstrate what those principles are through the research of a Canadian gentleman called John Hutchison, which is what is also in Dr. Wood's book and is in my books too.
Yeah, it's a kind of complex web, isn't it, Andrew? Because, you know, obviously we all can agree that the official story is a load of hooey, okay? But, you know, from when I started looking into 9/11, I looked at the whole, what do you call it? Words just gone out of my head. You know, how the towers are taken down deliberately, you know, the controlled demolition, that's what was coming to my head.
Yes. Demolition.
And I was looking at that, and then I heard stories about a mini nuke and all these different things. And I heard you and Dr. Judy Wood being on an interview, and I was blown away by this. I thought, what? And I was quite intrigued by it. And I looked at your websites and everything, and I just saw what you're talking about, you know, the dustification of the buildings and everything.
Mm.
I just thought, this is phenomenal. This is way out there, you know. And I was finding it hard to get my head around it, to be quite honest with you.
This is one of the problems, yes, indeed. Yeah. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And, but, you know, we're in all sorts of different, as I say, different theories as to how it all happened. And then, of course, you have the CGI, where planes, no planes. And it's very hard for people to figure out actually what did happen on that day, isn't it? And there's so much...
It is. And I mean, it's essentially, that's why Dr. Wood produced her book. It wasn't just for that reason, but that was one of the reasons. And I realised that there was going to be this confusion because I'd experienced that same confusion or some of it myself. You know, and that's why I ended up writing two books, and people can download these books from my website for free, the electronic versions, and get paperbacks if they want. And they're called 9/11 Finding the Truth and 9/11 Holding the Truth. And if you work your way through those books, you will see, I hope you will understand why, you know, these different theories have been promulgated and set up, because the short answer is it is to hide real technology. And they want to keep it hidden because if people knew about it and understood it and understood bits about how it worked, they would say, well, actually, we can use that technology to make the world a better place rather than using it to blow up things and turn things to dust. You know, and this is what Dr. Wood was. That's what her message was. As soon as she realized that's what the truth was, you know, and it is, it's a real physical truth. It's not a belief system or anything like that. You know, this is a reality, and this is why we've worked so hard to stick with the evidence and try and explain it to people, even though it is, as you said, difficult to get your head around because you haven't, you know, you've not come across anything like it before. You know,
how long did it take to set this up? I wonder, Andrew.
Well, I mean, you know, again, you look at things like certain Hollywood movies, which are very, very interesting, and you wonder, was 9/11 planned decades in advance? Were the Twin Towers actually built with someone's understanding that they would be destroyed?
Mm.
And it sounds really, you think, now that's just, that sounds like some crazy science fiction film plot or something. But, you know, when you actually start to look at the role of Hollywood in putting imagery into people's minds,
yeah,
you think, yeah, that's actually, there's really something very strange going on. And I can give you a couple of pointers. You know, really, you've got to go and look into that for yourself, I think. But there's a very good video made by a chap called Carl James, who's a friend of mine, actually. And he looks into, and he's not the only person to do it, other people did this a few years ago, he looks into the first Back to the Future film, which of course was made in 1985. And there are several quite prominent, once you see them, 9/11 references in that film. and it's really quite peculiar. So I recommend that you watch his video. I think there's another one by Jay Dyer, but he misses out some of the stuff, the important stuff that Carl James puts in his video, and it's very much worthwhile watching that. And I'll give you another little thing which I've mentioned in my second 9/11 book that I've known about for quite a number of years, in that you go across from the World Trade Center, where that was, and I was actually at the World Trade Center site in August last year. It's the third time I've been there in my life. First time was in 1991, before it was destroyed. You have the Millennium Hotel. And the Millennium Hotel, it used to be owned by the Hilton Group, but I think it's been sold to somebody else now, some other group. And I remember going back onto the Hilton Hotel website, and it told you what the design of the Millennium Hotel was based on, the shape of it. It was actually based on the monolith from the Stanley Kubrick 2001 Space Odyssey film. So this is pretty peculiar way out stuff, because how is it that you've got this hotel which is based, the shape of it is based on the shape of the monolith in the 2001 film? It says so on their website. The World Trade Center was destroyed in 2001, which is technically the first year of the new millennium. And there are several, a number of other things like that which you can find out about the World Trade Center site and when the World Trade Center was built and so forth. Now, some people can write this off as a sort of coincidence, but I, you know, have come to the conclusion that not only are we talking about technology, which, you know, destroyed the World Trade Center and how important that is to us, but this was done as part of a larger ritual. And even Dr. Wood herself has said that 9/11 was an attack on human consciousness. And I think this is very much what it was. And if you look at the way that it's polarized people and polarized parts of our society and the systems by which our society is run, we've had a number of people, you know, perhaps many of whom are listening to the, well, not many, but in the group that I'm thinking of, there are quite a number who listen to these sorts of programs. They become curious. They know that there's more going on in the world than, you know, just feeding ourselves and money and, you know, and just having a normal life and having family and children. There's more going on than that. There's some bigger thing going on. They've realized that and they want to know more. 9/11 has triggered a number of people to move in that direction, finding out this bigger picture, which I've started to mention some things about, you know, Millennium Hotel and that sort of thing. And there's a lot more. And then it's other people have gone the other way. They've gone into, oh, there's terrorists everywhere. Oh, they're going to kill us. Oh, we've got to put more locks on our doors. Oh, we've got to have more police. We've got to have this measure. We've got to have that measure to protect us from these evil people who are going to kill us. You know, a number of people have gone in that direction. So you could say that this, that 9/11, the event of 9/11 is like a gateway in human consciousness.
Yes.
Some people have gone one way through that gateway. Other people have gone the other way. Now, the large majority, the very large majority, are on one side, and a small minority are on the other, with this suspicion or this curiosity or this desire to learn more. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's that. I think is what is going on with this occult ritual, which was a big part of why 9/11 was done. It works on multiple levels. You know, of course, you can see it purely on a political level. You can see it purely on a monetary level in that, for example, all the companies that were selling security equipment, you know, they become, you know, multi-billion dollar companies, you know, per year now because of all the equipment they've sold as a result of the fear and panic which was caused after the events of 9/11. And, you know, other events since.
That's astonishing. Yeah, go on, Brian.
Andrew, another you know, people are looking at as well is the Israeli connection. You know, we've
been discussing
Israelis, all of that, and there is a lot of evidence to show that Israel has a lot of this advanced technology. What's your take on all of that? Christopher Berlin does a lot of good stuff on that, and you know, I have to, you know, look at.
Well, I'll say a couple of things on that. Okay. Yeah, definitely there's an Israel connection. I'm not sure I believe all the stories about, you know, all the, like the one of the stories that came out early on was that there was an Israeli company, several Israeli companies working in the towers, which got prior warning, so their employees didn't go to work on 9/11. You know, those stories have been circulating for a while. They may be true. I'm not sure if they're true or not. What is true is that a number of high-profile American politicians have dual Israeli nationality. The creation of the State of Israel in 1948, that at the modern state of Israel, that is tied into this larger picture of things. I have no doubt about that. I also have no doubt what Israel and other Jewish sympathizers claim about the Holocaust. I also have no doubt that those claims are untrue. But I don't doubt that hundreds of thousands of people died in German concentration camps, but they weren't gassed to death in these chambers. There's no doubt that that story is false.
Absolutely,
and you can tell that it's false by the level of propaganda that is put out about it, and all these museums that are built and all this silliness. But going back to Chris Berlin is a liar. He and people like Richard Gage are liars. They're telling lies about 9/11. They try to promote their lie-telling tours in our Facebook group, which they were prevented from doing so. Chris Berlin lies about Dr. Judy Wood, even though he may be telling the truth about certain aspects of Israel. And there is no excuse for this. There is no excuse for people claiming that they're telling the truth about Israel or Zionism or, you know, Hitler or the banking system, and then lying about 9/11. They don't get a free pass to lie about 9/11 and lie about people that have set up court cases just because they might be telling the truth about another emotive issue. So that's what I've got to say about Chris Berlin.
That's interesting.
There's a comment actually in the chat room from our page that heard Chris Berlin say on the Power Hour, I haven't read all of Judy Wood's book, but I know she's wrong.
Who says that?
Christopher Berlin.
Chris Berlin says that. Well, how does he know that she's wrong?
If he's not read the book.
If he's not read the book, exactly.
He is very vocal about Israel.
That doesn't matter, though. That, you know, Israel is irrelevant in
terms
of...
he won't touch the direct energy weapon thing.
No, he won't. He won't. That's because it undermines a lot of the other stories which are told about things like Israel. Now, Israel may have access to the technology which destroyed the World Trade Center, but we know, for example, that Science Applications International Corporation, which is a big military-industrial contractor, they were on the group of contractors that helped NIST write the World Trade Center reports. That is a fact. You can go and check that on the government's website. They were paid money, you know, and they were also in charge of Ground Zero security. Hardly anyone talks about SAIC. A lot of people talk about Israel, for example, or Zionism, but very few people will focus on the details of some of these large, powerful military-industrial contractors as well. And what you've also got to get a handle on, if you want the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, is you have to get a handle on the fact that groups like SAIC have this advanced technology. They know about it, and there is likely to be connections into black programs which most people don't even want to think about. I'm talking about things like things crashing in 1947 in Roswell, New Mexico, things being recovered from that and then taken and developed into technology. That's not just a story. That happened. That happened. And there is some connection between that event and other events which lead to certain connections to 9/11. Now, I don't know all of the path, but I know that the same people that are lying about 9/11 are also lying about other events like the energy connection to 9/11, for example, with cold fusion, that they will lie about that as well. So this is what people have got to get a handle on.
I can't understand why they would not do that. I mean, I also saw where...
I can't understand it. That's why I've written two books about it, to try and, you know, that's why I've written two books about it, to try and get to the bottom of why people are lying about it.
Yeah, because I remember you were talking to, what's the name from Richard D. Hall on richplanet.net, and you were telling him about when you met David Icke. You
had a two-hour
conversation with him, and you brought up the directed energy weapons, and he seemed very interested in it because
he
talks a lot about energy and all of that and consciousness and all that type of stuff. Right. And it looked like he was going to take it further, and then nothing.
Well, this is exactly my point. You've picked a very good example. Now, David Icke, I mean, we could talk all night about David Icke. He's done such a lot of brilliant research. He's done all these books. He's done world tours, you know, and I've learned a lot from David Icke. We said all this, people go and watch the Rich Planet program. We weren't trying to bash him, you know, because we know that he's brought out a lot of good stuff. He's helped us all, you know, this movement going through this gateway that he described earlier. David Icke talks about that sort of thing as well. He's helped a lot of people in those areas. But that still does not excuse him from not telling the truth about 9/11 and denying that the concept of energy weapons and how they work is important. Now, he actually, after the book came out, we were contacted by somebody who ran his website. I think it was, I think his ex-wife ran his web shop for a period of time. And we were contacted by her and said, would we send out copies of the Where Did the Towers Go book? And I did that. I was sending out copies from my house here, same house I live in now, probably for 2 or 3 years, because David Icke had it listed on his website as one of the books, you know, that he recommended. So we would sell them to David Icke, you know, at slightly less than we were selling them, and they would make a small profit on it. And I was sending them out. So all they would do was send the orders. And I was quite happy to do that, because obviously David Icke has a big following. So any exposure to his audience, you know, that we could get was useful for us. But then after a period of time, that he just delisted it from his website. We didn't receive any explanation. We didn't receive any complaints from anybody, you know, of damaged books or books not being sent or anything like that. And then the next thing I heard after that, which was probably a couple of years, was this episode that we discussed on the Rich Planet program, where David Icke did this interview with Richie Allen, and he said that the truth about what happened to the World Trade Center was we shouldn't be arguing childishly over it. You know, we should, it wasn't important. All we needed to agree on was that 9/11 was done to allow what followed to happen. No, David, no. You mean you don't want to talk about weather modification? You don't want to talk about the ability to turn solid objects into dust with no heat and no light? You don't want to talk about that, you know? Well, I'm sorry, David, but I do want to talk about it. And you're not going to tell me what is good, you know, to talk about what isn't, because that is you doing exactly what you say the government should do.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
It's hypocritical. That's what I'm on about.
Yeah,
I think it is with these people. They go so far, Andrew. Like, I agree with you, David. Icke brought me a lot of information. I got a lot of respect for him. But at the end of the day, it seems to me they can only go so far, and then the gun's put to their head.
Something like this is going on, and I don't know quite what it is. But you know, it hasn't happened to me. I, for example, did quite a lot of research into 9/11 up to 2007, and I printed booklets. I'd given out hundreds of DVDs, all kinds of stuff. I realised I was wrong. I realised that this idea of thermite being in the buildings was untrue. I'd made a mistake, and I admitted it, and I told people, and I now use that, and I explain, I use that to help people, you know, hopefully try and learn for themselves that, yes, we all make mistakes. We think we know the truth. We've made a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, we go back and we say, look, I was wrong. You know, this is what I now know. This is why I was wrong. You know, I'm a tutor for the Open University, you know, so I get a student assignment, bits of it are wrong, and I have to say to the student, look, I'm sorry, that's wrong, this is the right answer, you know, do you understand how to get from the wrong answer to the right answer? If you do, then I've done my job. If you don't, then I haven't done my job, so tell me what you don't understand. And this is how you learn. It's having the humility to realise you've made a mistake. And then you build on that, you grow, and you learn. You know, and I mean, I'm not saying that I don't like to admit that I'm wrong, you know. And I'll have a family argument, and then I realise that I'm wrong. And I'm uncomfortable admitting that I'm wrong, you know.
Yeah.
But I do it.
Yeah, you have to. As you gain knowledge, you realise that.
You learn, and you don't grow.
No.
You don't learn, and you don't grow if you don't admit that you're wrong.
You have to admit to your mistakes, and we've made plenty, Bryzer, have we not?
Oh yeah, we have. Yeah.
And they'll keep coming as we try and follow out this truth. You know, it's so difficult.
Sometimes you slap yourself around the face because how did I not miss that? You know what I mean? But you have to acknowledge, make a mistake, and you move on, and you kind of, you know, you challenge yourself all the time. This is what getting to the truth is all about, you know? So
that's right. And I mean, this goes back to the earlier point. You know, if there's something wrong with Dr. Judy Wood's material or material on my website, tell us what it is exactly. Give us a reference. Why is it wrong? Tell us now. We want to know. Mm. Because if we've done it wrong and you know why it's wrong and you know what's right, you're going to help us improve that material and make it, you know, higher quality. Sure. Why would we not want that? Why would we not want that?
Has anybody come out and tried to rebut her or try to...
Oh, yeah, all the time. But there are no...
Has anybody just come out with something feasible or anything?
No, that's basically what it is. And that's what I was going to go on to say. So I've been, you know, I've been looking at Dr. Judy Wood's material for 11 years. And I've been waiting for somebody to dispute it. And none of it's been disputed, not in any substantial way. You know, people have argued about minor details like, oh, you know, there might be a picture of a car and Dr. Judy Wood has labelled it on Vesey Street. And it wasn't actually on Vesey Street. It was on the next street along or something like that. You know, there's been little things like that. But we've never even established whether that little thing is actually true. Do you see what I mean? So there might be minor details like that. But there is no dispute that, for example, the buildings, they did not burn up. They did not slam to the ground. They turned to dust in midair. That's what happened, right? And that is a set of facts which are only explicable by the use of a technology which isn't on the radar screen. Mm-hmm. It isn't on anybody's radar screen. That's my point. And I've been waiting for somebody to give an alternative explanation which explains the evidence. I've been waiting for that for 11 years, and none has been forthcoming from anywhere.
Yeah, there's another thing too, Andrew. There was forest fires in California last year. I'm sure you've heard about them.
Yes.
A lot of people putting out that direct energy weapons were used. And I have to say, I saw some of the videos, and it looked very 9/11-ish, if you saw what I mean. Strange houses being built, you know, a house in the middle of street being burnt down and houses
Sure. We got a lot of messages.
Do you think that the same thing was used there, or what do you think?
Well, the answer is on my website already, and I'll give you a summary. Yeah. We started to get a lot of messages about that, and there was one particular video which came out. I think it was early October. I think it was about the particular incident in one of the affected areas. What was quite peculiar that there were a number of areas affected in quite similar ways over a period, I think, of a couple of months, and it seemed, it did look superficially as if they were being zapped with something, you know, and then the fires were starting. But again, I looked at one of these videos, and there were some peculiar effects which I wasn't sure that I could explain. But two things: it certainly didn't prove the use of a directed energy weapon. All we saw was certain burning effects which looked slightly anomalous, and some of them looked anomalous because people don't understand how things burn. Like, for example, the houses were completely burnt to the ground, whereas the trees, you know, down the street were only partly burned, and people expect it all to be burned. But a lot of these houses were made of wood, right? And the wood gets very dry, particularly in a dry climate like they were where they were. So that wood burns very easily, but the tree is living. Mm-hmm. So the tree doesn't burn as readily because it's, you know, it's got sap in it and everything, which doesn't burn as readily as the houses. So when you see all these houses completely destroyed, but the tree's still standing, it looks a bit weird. Now, most of the people that were making comments about these California fires hadn't visited the site. They hadn't, for example, looked at weather maps. They hadn't, for example, looked at seismic readings. They hadn't looked at all these other types of evidence. They hadn't, for example, spent 3 years investigating the California wildfires before posting their first web page about it. You know, they'd looked at a couple of videos from the site and then posted their video the next day. I'm saying that because Dr. Judy Wood studied the events of 9/11 and gathered pictures and images for 3 years before she posted anything anywhere on the internet. Now, you know, we went through some of the videos because people were showing the California wildfires, and then they were showing clips from Dr. Judy Wood's lecture, which we thought was, well, you know, anybody can make a video. If they want to do that, that's fair enough. But we thought that that wasn't a strong enough, you know, link between it. And we ended up, because we started getting loads of messages about it, we were getting fed up of replying to all these messages. Oh, have you seen these California wildfires? Have you seen this? Have you seen that? And we watched a few of the videos. We decided to record a half an hour chat about what our thoughts were, right? And I put that on my YouTube channel, and I actually disabled comments on that video deliberately because I knew what was going to happen. People were going to say, and they did say, that we'd said that the California wildfires weren't a directed energy weapon. That's not what we said. We just said that the evidence that we saw didn't convince us that a directed energy weapon was used, which isn't the same thing as saying it wasn't a directed energy weapon. We were basically saying we didn't know what it was, and we also were saying that to claim it was a directed energy weapon was irresponsible until you'd done a full investigation and given, you know, a comprehensive analysis and relied on somebody with expertise in analyzing fires, right? And we basically got hate mail for that. I got hate mail for saying that, and I've put a sample of that on my website. And really, people shouldn't have even, you know, they shouldn't have said that, because all I am is just a guy with a website, a researcher. You know, like I said, I stumble across these things. I research them, I post articles. People ask me to come on radio programs, and I say, yeah. People ask me to do talks, I say, yeah. You know, if you pay my travel expenses, I'll go and do them. And that's all I do. I'm not a government official. I don't get paid to do investigations. You know, I investigate things because I'm curious. I write about things and put them on my website because I think people might want to know, you know. So people shouldn't hate me because I don't want to investigate what they're asking me to investigate for them, you know, and asking me for my opinion. I'll give an opinion. I gave my opinion, but they didn't like it. You know, it's tough, you know. So, you know, I'm going off on a bit of a, you know, Barney here, whatever you want to call it, whatever. But we felt that people were posting videos, right, about the California wildfires and trying to link them to the Dr. Judy Wood research to make it look more ridiculous, or more as if that was poorly researched material as well as these other videos. That's what we felt was going on. And there are a couple of other people, you know, clued into this. We have a Facebook group that I post in fairly regularly for 9/11 research. And there are a couple of people specifically said in that group that they thought that this was another psychological operation to attach, you know, inconclusive research to Dr. Judy Wood's conclusive research. And they explicitly said that, and I ended up agreeing with them, you know. I mean, I had people commenting on one of my videos on YouTube saying, why did you disable comments on that California wildfires video? Because they were so desperate to comment on it. You know, so they had to go and comment on another video. I mean, what is going on with people? You know, what is going on? You know, that's the desperation that I'm led to. You know,
you can see how some people would like to think, well, this, you know, you can see it on 9/11 and why they would do it. These forest fires, because that area in California was designated as an Agenda 21 area, and right, a very nice way to clear people out of that area. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, absolutely. But
you can see, you know, why people would want to try and say, well,
you can.
Do you think that these people went a little bit too far then? Do you think that they...
Basically, yes. I mean, if you read that article that I posted on my website, I do mention the Agenda 21 issue because I'd researched that previously. Yes, I can certainly understand why people's suspicions are aroused. But again, you know, you think of the Agenda 21 issue. If they were really, you know, trying to burn those houses down to clear those areas of groups of people or certain, you know, middle class people or something like that, they could have just as easily have done that with some type of incendiary device. They wouldn't have necessarily needed to use a directed energy weapon. Mm. Or they could have used some more, what you might call, conventional technology. There's not necessarily a need to link it to the 9/11 research without good evidence for doing so, you know. That was the main point we were trying to make.
Okay, I think fascinating stuff. You know, we've been doing radio, or I've been doing radio now for 3 years, and it seems incredible. This is the first time I've done a show on 9/11. I always wanted to go back and visit it because it is the event that changed the world for everyone. Mm-hmm. And of course, we got the internet about the same time, so it's opened up so many doors. 9/11, and we haven't even talked about World Trade Building 7 yet. I'm sure we'll come to that later. No. But in the meantime, folks, we'll take a quick short wee break now. We'll have a little quick 4.5 to 5 minutes, I think, in the company of Toto and Africa. Don't go away, folks. Africa by Toto. What a great song that is. You're listening to The Graham Hart Show here on Cornwall Revolution Radio, folks, and our guest this evening is Mr. Andrew Johnson out of Derby. And we've been talking 9/11, which is quite interesting because, as I said earlier, we've not had one guest on, Bri, to talk about 9/11 since we started the show, or since I've been on radio. So
really, I mean, we have touched on it, but we haven't really gone
into. No, not in any detail.
I remember actually interviewing Andrew about 6-7 years ago on CNS Radio after his discussion with Judy Wood, and I was very interested. I wanted to know more, you know. So, you know, just see how things are going. And Andrew, can I just touch again on the California thing? I mean, with regard to, directed energy weapons, if they won't use it to kind of for Agenda 21 purposes, what would they use it for? So, you know, they use it for 9/11. What else do you think they could use it for in a malicious way?
Well, I don't know what else they would use it for, really. I mean, whether it was used in California or not, as I said earlier, I don't know. I'm not saying it wasn't used there. It's just that I think that people were jumping too quickly to conclusions, right? And I think that creates more problems than it solves when you jump to conclusions. That's basically all I was saying, right. And also pointing out that people shouldn't get mad at me for advising them that they're jumping to conclusions and pointing out that this can be quite damaging to established research. That's really all I was saying on that. In terms of other uses of directed energy, well, going back in history a little bit, there is some evidence, I think, that the directed energy weapons were used in Iraq. There was a very interesting film produced by Rye News in 2003 called, I think, Star Wars in Iraq, I think was its title. That's, I think, still available online. That's also quite interesting. There is additional information on Dr. Judy Webb's website. I'm dredging my memory a bit because there were some pictures, I think, that she or somebody working with her found of weapons caches, I think, from Iraq or Afghanistan, you know, like piles and piles of guns, which look to be really strangely rusted. And maybe even fused together. Again, I'm going back about 10 years in my memory, and we wondered at that point if they'd use some type of energy weapon to basically neutralize this arms dump somehow. So, you know, the various possible instances of use of this technology. Another one is the Alfred P. Murrah building in 1995 in the so-called Oklahoma City bombing, which maybe wasn't a bombing. I've got an article about that on my website, which links to a series by somebody called Harry Mason called Bright Skies, which also might be another possible. He documented another usage possibly of some type of directed energy technology. But what relationship these things have precisely to the events of 9/11, you know, we don't know for sure, and I'm just sort of advising caution in jumping to conclusions, basically.
Yeah, I have to say the Oklahoma thing does not look like a bomb when you look at the damage at the front of the building. That doesn't look like what a car bomb did that, you know.
Well, I mean, what Dr. Wood pointed out to me, again, about 10 years ago, is if you look at the pictures of the inside of World Trade Center Building number 6...
Hello?
Hello?
I think we've lost Andrew.
Andrew dropped me.
Just checking. Saying he's still online.
Andrew, are you back? I still.
He's showing still with us, but. Oh, yeah. Yep, everything's working okay this end. Oh, he's dropped now. I'll try and call him in again a minute, Bri. He's showing away, but he was before. Excuse us, folks.
Live radio?
Live radio. Oh. Cough when you need to cough. Clear your throat. While you don't move. I'm not making a connection at the moment. So what do you think of it so far?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, again, you know, 9/11 is so complicated. I'm trying to make up my mind what happened, you know. I mean, it's important that we do know.
Yeah.
How it happened, who did it, and why they did it, you know. There's just so much convolution, you know, all these convoluted theories. I mean, we just don't know for definite.
No.
And I have to say myself, just looking at Dr. Judy Wood, it seems to me the most plausible of them. I mean, I know there's other ones, and I look at, they're very interesting as well, I have to say. But, you know, she's done the real scientific research on all of this, and a lot of it adds up, you know.
Yeah.
That's just my opinion. Again, I could be wrong. I don't know. You know, I'm not a physicist either, so I can't say, but just the way those buildings just disappeared into dust was just, that was weird. Weird.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, you have to remember that Dr. Judy Wood is the only person that's taken this call. I think my Skype call dropped out there.
Yes,
somehow,
it did.
For some reason.
You did, yeah. You've now come back, Andrew. You've now come back.
Good, good. I don't know where you lost me, if I was sounding incoherent or...
No, you just...
Oh, no, I think you talked about Oklahoma. You said Judy Wood said something about Building 6 in the World Trade Center.
Right. So if you look at World Trade Center 6 and the Alpha P. Mirar building, the damage to those buildings, it looks virtually indistinguishable. That's on her website. So, you know, I think she also found later on some pictures of a few toasted cars at the Alpha P. Mirar building as well. And I've got some of those pictures on my website. So, We did wonder if that was another usage of some type of similar weapon system. And also the thing I said, I think probably when my Skype had dropped, was that there are significant water features at both the site of the World Trade Center and the Alpha P. Mirar building as well. So, you know, make of that what you will.
Okay. So, will we move on from 9/11, Graham, or do you want to... There's other things that I know that Andrew looks into lots.
Absolutely, yeah. I just wanted to say about advertising, when he was saying, Andrew was saying about it was planned years ago. I mean, it showed up on the 9/11, showed up on the Supertramp album, and it was also...
Correct.
I believe it was something in The Simpsons as well, was there not, Andrew?
Well, there's a whole raft of these, actually, and I found a good page... which, if people are interested, I can send them. It collects quite a few of these together. But off the top of my head, the ones I can remember, it was references to the towers being destroyed or turned to dust or similar sorts of damage. We have very overt references in things like DuckTales, which was a 1997 Disney comic strip. We've got references in the Super Mario Brothers film from 1993. The Simpsons, as you say, is another one. I think there was some reference in the early Spider-Man trailer. There was I think the Spider-Man reboot from which was meant to come out in 2001. They had a trailer with the Twin Towers in it. They had to check that trailer was never released publicly. Mm. Although I think it's found its way onto YouTube if you go and look for that. There's references in The Long Kiss Goodbye, in the Lone Gunman film. Or pilot episode, I think there's probably about 50 highly significant references to in Hollywood films and things like The Simpsons and TV series and so forth. Very weird.
Yeah, yes, it is indeed. And you mentioned Stanley Kubrick earlier on, and you've also, maybe we can move on to that shortly, but you've done some studies on the moon landings, which everybody seems to, or those, the awakened ones seem to know that it was a Stanley Kubrick film. I think there's clips of it on YouTube. But I was going back to the towers. Those explosions that we've seen as the building came down, Andrew, are they involved, or is that just is that to distract your attention from using energy?
Well, I think what we came to conclude on this, because I think probably what you're referring to is these little squirts coming out, or squibs coming out.
Yes.
Is that what you're thinking of?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think what's happening there, if you look at the ones on building number 7, they're actually fairly insignificant on building 7. And we know that building 7 wasn't a controlled demolition. Now, I've got another video which proves that it wasn't a controlled demolition, where we've got an emergency medical technician called Barbara Crowley. And she's about 3 or 4 or 5 blocks away from the World Trade Center being interviewed by a guy. And building number 7 is in the background of the shot while she's being interviewed. And she's talking about, you know, the sort of terrible scene at the World Trade Center, saying they need water and supplies and medical supplies and stuff. And while she's being interviewed, you see building number 7 dropping to the ground.
Oh, right. I've not seen that.
And the interviewer's saying, oh, 7's going down. And she goes, what are you talking about? And she looks around, and they see it going down. She's going, oh, my God. It doesn't even hear it. There's no sound. It's virtually silent.
Wow.
If they were taking that building down, you'd be hearing these bang, 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 these charges going off blocks and blocks away, you know. And there are other reasons as well, because it only had a seismic signature of 0.6. It's another important factor. So, but anyway, going back to the squibs on the World Trade Center, where we've got these what look like charges going off. Well, if you look, there are no flashes of light associated with those squibs coming out. No obvious flashes of light. Okay, so you could say, well, the charges were deep inside the building. No, well, you still would have heard them. You hear them on all controlled demolitions. They're very loud. But the other thing we think caused those patterns of, you know, squibs coming out, was we think that was exploding air tanks. Exploding tanks, such as fire extinguishers. There was also turbo toilets in the World Trade Center towers, which had pressurized water system. In other words, if you think how the World Trade Center plumbing worked, they couldn't pump up the water from the top in one big long pipe, from the bottom to the top, I should say. They had to pump it up in stages. So there were certain pressurized tanks, you know, at various points in the towers, and we would suggest that what you were seeing was these pressurized tanks, while they were being dustified, basically, or partially dustified, once that tank had been breached, you know, bang, that you get that explosive effect. And indeed, we have reports from the fire trucks. There was a number of firefighters, if you read the witness accounts, they said their oxygen tanks were exploding on the backs of the trucks. Their air tanks, rather, I should say, not oxygen tanks. I've been told off for calling them oxygen tanks because they weren't. They were air tanks.
I didn't know that.
No. Yeah, so it's,
that's very interesting.
Yeah, that's it. So you know, did they put thermite in the air tanks of the fire trucks? You can go and read the accounts. You know, there's several accounts of that happening. Scott packs, they call them. They were exploding spontaneously. You know, so how do you explain that?
Mm. Well, that's interesting. That's very interesting. So basically, the buildings were brought down by using these high energy techniques.
Well, you say high energy. This is making an assumption about how it works.
Yeah.
People have tried to say it was high energy, but
what would you call it?
How I explain it is if you imagine, for example, a row of dominoes which have been set up in a particular way, you know, 10,000 dominoes, and you imagine that, just say by some weirdness, you didn't know that the dominoes were all in a line, and you could just see them from one angle, and you had no comprehension that they were all in line, and you wanted to knock those dominoes down, so you ended up flicking them one by one. You've got you know, you've got 100,000 dominoes that you have to knock down. You flick them one by one. You imagine how long that's going to take, the amount of energy you're going to expend. Yeah. But then, because you're clever, you suddenly realize that these dominoes are all arranged in a certain way, and you can just tap one of them, and all the rest will go down. You won't need to expend any more energy. I made that analogy 10 years ago to try and explain how we think the weapon system works, in that it's able to tap into the underlying nuclear or atomic structure of material such that it can send something into that material and just make it fall apart, make it become dissociated, start off some chain reaction or some process, and all the energy that's needed to do it is already in the material. It's already in the material. It's been there since that material was formed. You just have to find a way to, you know, trigger the reaction and set it going. You see what I mean?
Yes.
So the actual input energy may not have been very much. It's just, this is why we think it might be in a resonance effect of some kind, which is what John Hutchison was experimenting with. So, you know, this idea of it being high energy is often used to say, I mean, in fact, this Dr. Greg Jenkins character, he says, oh, you could never generate that much energy. It would take 15 terawatts to do that to the tower, and nobody can generate that much energy in 10 seconds, so it couldn't have been done. Well, I'm sorry, Greg, but the tower's no longer there. So that means that somehow what was done, because they're gone, you know. So that means that a technology exists to do it. That's it, you know, end off.
Okay.
A lot of people are wondering what's your opinion on who actually was behind this.
Well, we don't know who is behind it, you know. But I think we know who knows. Science Applications International Corporation, they know who did 9/11. So do Applied Research Associates and people connected with them. They know who did 9/11. So I suggest if anybody wants to know who destroyed the towers, they write to people at Science Applications International Corporation and Applied Research Associates. Of course, we took them to court, or I say we, Dr. Judy Wood did, and I helped out with some of the documentation for that back in 2008. But we got almost no support. We got support from about 10 people to do that, and it cost thousands of dollars. And we did that because we knew that what we were saying was true, and we could prove it in a court of law. Unfortunately, the court didn't let us try and prove it, and the contractors were never put under oath. So, you know, there you go. But they know. They know who did 9/11. So I suggest you ask them.
Oh. Yeah, because again, I keep going back to, like, I look at Israel, I look at the Talpiot program, I look at what energy or what technology these guys have.
You may be right. There could be a group in Israel that has some connection into SAIC, or they're in control of SAIC. I don't actually know, so I'm not prepared to say that there is. I know that there is some advanced tech companies based in Israel. You know, do they control and influence US companies? Maybe. I don't know, though.
Yeah, then you got Lucky Larry Silverstein, you know, who was involved with...
Well, of course, yes, I mean, I'm familiar with his you know, the story about him, and whatever you say about him, did he know about that they used directed energy weapons? He might have done, but we can't prove that he knew, you know. Yeah. I think it's safe to say that he was complicit, and he knew that they had to do something to the World Trade Center. He may not have been aware of the date, he may not have been aware of the details of it, but we can be pretty sure that he knew something was going down. And even if he didn't know beforehand, he helped them out. He didn't say, "What have you done to my buildings? You know, what have you done?" He didn't say anything like that.
No,
he helped them out.
No,
so,
well, that's very interesting. I never know. I've never studied that or thought about that. Yeah, he didn't look a bit worried, did he? In fact, he looked quite pleased. And that
he probably knew. But you know, whether he knew, how much he knew about directed energy weapons or SAIC's involvement or the military industrial complex, that you know, that's just guesswork. And he's never going to admit it. These people are never going to admit, we killed 3,000 people. Yeah, okay, well, admit it now, you know. I mean, we're already, you know, 17 years on. We're going to get to the point with the Kennedy assassination, you know.
Yeah.
Most of the people that are involved within that operation, they're mostly dead now anyway. So that's perhaps why a bit more information has come out over the years as people die off. You know, it'll be the same with 9/11. The people that knew stuff will die off, and, you know, we won't get to know. Nobody will admit it. we'll only be able to find out what we found out now and a bit more, maybe, you know, as the years go by.
And of course, there was that famous shot on the BBC, Andrew, with Jane Stanley, which of course everyone's seen.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
That was just ridiculous.
It was. You know, but I mean, again, Dr. Woods pointed out a couple of issues with that. Not to debunk it or anything, but again, it's a bit like the Silverstein story. It does show that somebody knew something weird was going on, but that's almost all you can say, because Dr. Wood pointed out that they said that one Liberty Plaza had collapsed. That was reported by CNN, and this one Liberty Plaza was a large skyscraper, again, just about the same distance as building number 7 was from the WTC, and that was announced as having collapsed, you know, earlier in the day, but of course it hadn't. Mm. So, you know, does it prove complicit in the events? Maybe, but there are far more important things, you know, to my way of thinking, like, you know, illustrating the connection between the events of 9/11 and people like Stephen E. Jones, who was a cold fusion researcher in the 1980s, and that whole set of research is very, very few people talk about that, because, you know, some of it is a bit technical and stuff, and people don't really want to get their head around it.
Okay, I don't know if there's anything more you wanted to say on that, Andrew, on 9/11. I was going to move on to Stanley Kubrick and the moon landings.
Sure.
Please tell me more.
Yeah.
And this seems to be quite popular at the moment. I'm seeing videos popping around now about the moon landings. So what was your research? How did you come to look at that?
Yeah, well, I mean, people can read my free ebook called Finding the Secret Space Program and Removing Truth Protective Layers, and that's got 4 chapters on the Apollo hoax, and, you know, I'll mention the Stanley Kubrick thing in a minute, but the thing that really shook me up when I discovered this was the speech by Neil Armstrong in 1994 that he made on the 25th anniversary of the moon landing, and literally it was in the White House in the presence of President Clinton, on 20th of July 1994, and he said, "We have today a group of students with us, some of America's best. We say to you, we have only completed a beginning. We leave you much that is undone. There are breakthroughs, great ideas undiscovered, and breakthroughs available to those who can remove one of truth's protective layers. There are places to go beyond belief." So this is Armstrong on the anniversary of the moon landings talking about removing truth's protective layers. What?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
What is he going on about? You know, and then you start to look into that, and you find all kinds of problems, which I go through in the book. And, you know, people quickly will jump to the photo anomalies and the shadows going in the wrong direction. Well, yeah, some of them do, but some of those photographs are also equivocal in that area. So I don't, you know, strongly talk about that. I mention a couple of them, the major ones. But the heat issues are more prominent to me, in that if you read the information on, you know, any reputable websites, such as university websites, Britannica.com or lunar data websites, they will tell you that the average surface temperature on the moon is 100 degrees centigrade. That's the average. That's, you know, hot enough to boil water.
Yeah.
And when in broad daylight, I think it gets up to about, I don't know, 123 degrees centigrade. So the cameras that they took, for example, weren't special cameras, apart from having a chest mounting on them, and they didn't use special film. They just used, I think, Ektachrome 64 Kodak film in the cameras, you know, these Hasselblad cameras. So it wasn't special film, and there wasn't special cameras. You put a camera like that, you know, and put it into an oven on a low temperature, what's going to happen to the camera?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
What's going to happen to it? You know, when it's been there for half an hour, isn't the film going to warp in the camera and stop the sprockets rolling along?
A tad.
Never mind. I haven't even got to the radiation. I'm just talking about the heat.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
And then you start to look, for example, if you read Ralph Renée's book, which is very good, where he looked at some of the engineering aspects, because he had an engineering background. He looks at, for example, the spacesuits. And if you work out how much heat was incident on the astronauts, and you just even what they would need, you know, by moving around and sweating in a suit which is close to their skin, and to keep them cool in that sort of environment. The only way you can cool on the surface of the moon is you can use radiation, because there's no air, so you can't use conduction, so you can't transfer the heat through the astronaut's feet into the moon. You can't use radiation, really, because you can't radiate enough heat out, because you've got radiation coming in from the sun, radiated heat, that is. And you can't use convection because there's no air, there's no atmosphere to speak of. So the only way they can do this is by having water circulating around the suit, and then that when that water heats up, they eject it out into the vacuum to cool them down. And if you work out, do the calculations in terms of things like specific heat and latent heat, if you know about these things in physics, the volume of water that they would need to have carried around in those suits is, you know, you just couldn't have done it. You couldn't have carried enough water around in those suits to keep the astronauts cool, you know. The same goes for keeping the lunar module cool, that sort of thing. So the heat is a very, very, very big problem, far bigger than I ever realized initially. Then you look at some of the other photo anomalies, like one of the common ones is these things were meant to have landed with a rocket booster firing, yet you look underneath the lander and there's no dust on the legs of the craft. You know, there's nothing. And
there's no dent in the earth or anything.
You'd expect a radial pattern of streaks of dust, you know, going out from underneath the lander. So you would have seen this radial pattern of dust going out for tens or hundreds of meters. That's not on the pictures. That's not there. And there are many other anomalies. The other one, which I think is the most severe, which I've seen, is a little talked about picture of Charlie Duke. And the Apollo mission, I think, was, I always get 15, 16 and 17 mixed up, but I think it was Apollo 16. Charlie Duke was one of the astronauts. He took a family photograph in a plastic bag, left it on the surface of the moon, you know, a photo from Earth. And you see this picture, and I've got the image reference on my website and in my book, and it's in a plastic bag. This photograph is just lying there. But if you get a photograph and you put it in the oven, it will curl up. Yeah. It will convolve.
Yeah.
You know, and you, if you leave a photograph on the back seat of your car in the sun, you go back a couple of days later and it's curled up.
Sure.
And that's not even 100 degrees centigrade. That's what would have happened to this photograph on the moon instantaneously. Well, not instantaneously. In a couple of seconds, the plastic bag is barely shriveled. It would have shriveled up in that amount of heat because they didn't have thermoplastics bags in the way we have them now, you know, in those days in 1960, 71, 72, whenever it was. All kinds of problems. So, but going to the Stanley Kubrick link, which is what you asked about, again, this I think is maybe people jumping to conclusions slightly. I don't think there's any evidence to prove that Stanley Kubrick faked the moon landings and made the film in a Hollywood studio in the studio at Area 51. I think there is circumstantial evidence to suggest that he might have been involved in a project to, you know, to simulate the moon landing. Whether he was directly involved, I don't know. But it's possible that he knew somebody direct, you know, a close friend that was involved with it. And this, I think, is Jay Widener has more or less suggested this in his film called Kubrick's Odyssey. Yeah. And if you watch that, I don't think it's available online, but you have to buy the DVD. But if you listen to some of Jay Widener's interviews, I think he talks about that. And he makes the argument that in this film, The Shining, if anybody's watched this film, there are various clues in The Shining which suggest that Stanley Kubrick knew the truth about Apollo. And he points out, for example, that this is Jay Widener points out that there's a scene in The Shining where this character called Danny, the sort of 8-9 year old boy, he's playing with some toys on this carpet, and he stands up looking towards this apparition of these twin girls that have apparently been murdered. And he stands up, and as he stands up and faces the camera, you see on his jumper Apollo 11 USA on this jumper that he's wearing. And there's no real explanation as to why he's wearing this jumper in this scene. And you see him standing up, and this is Kubrick's symbolic launching of Apollo 11 in a fake scenario. It's a cartoon and it's knitted on this jumper. And there are other clues as well. It's not just that one. And then the character who talks to Danny about Shining, that I can't remember the name of the character, he dies in the Shining story. He gets murdered by Jack Nicholson, I think. And this was a change from the Stephen King novel. This didn't happen in the Stephen King novel. So there was a suggestion that Stanley Kubrick actually caused somebody to be killed because he found out about their involvement in the Apollo 11 fake program. I think Kubrick did know about Apollo. Whether he was involved in the events is less clear. It is certainly clear that the Apollo 11 mission and the filming of 2001: A Space Odyssey were running at the same time. The events were crossing over, and there are connections between people in NASA and people involved in the Stanley Kubrick production. There are some fairly obvious connections. I'm not an expert on those, but if you read Carl James's books, which are available free in PDF form, they're called Science Fiction and the Hidden Global Agenda, he's got quite a lot of material on Stanley Kubrick and the moon landing hoax.
Yeah, I would very much suggest that Stanley Kubrick did know. I think that's, I can't see how he couldn't have known.
Mm. That's more or less what I think.
I think Stanley was tuned into a lot of things, actually, when you look at a lot of his films. Mm.
Yeah.
Eyes Wide Shut being a really profound one, I think.
Jay Widener makes the argument, and I think it's a fairly good argument, that Kubrick knew about the secret elite clubs, Illuminati or Opus Dei or, the family or, Knights of Malta and all these other sort of secret and semi-secret societies. He knew what they were up to, and he kind of got a handle on that. But he wasn't a member. He either didn't want to join them, or he wasn't allowed to join them for whatever reason. He became a problem for the secret keepers because of what he knew, and they'd made a deal with Kubrick because he'd made the Doctor Strangelove film, which was a mockery of the military industrial complex, and one of the characters, the Peter Sellers character in that Doctor Strangelove film, was I think meant to be based on Curtis LeMay. I've recently been reading a little bit about that. They cut a deal with Kubrick after he made the Strangelove film, because he made a very good job of modelling the interior of the B-52 bomber, which was then classified. That was classified information, but Kubrick had managed to work it out. And because he did such a good job, Jay Widener argues that they realised he was a very, very, very good filmmaker, and they needed to give him some work, and that work was the Apollo mission. And his reward for doing that was to be able to make any movie he wanted for any budget he wanted, for the rest of his life. And that was how 2001 came to be made, which was an enormously expensive film and, very groundbreaking, and it was alchemical film, as Jay Widener argues, and showed the whole of human evolution, and was very symptomatic of and very indicative of the whole thing that's going on with the human race and what it's actually been doing for the last 200 millennia.
And another thing, go ahead, Brian.
No, I'm just saying,
there's just so many lies and fakery and nonsense going on out there.
Yeah,
and we're just trying to peel away the onions of all of them, and it's just so much of it, you know?
I think, yeah.
I mean, but I mean, I think we've particularly people listening to this all know, you know, we just have to keep plugging away and point people out to different things and realize that, you know, we're being lied to on a massive, massive scale. You know,
complete theater. That's
and until we kind of get our heads around that, then we may be able to do something. You know, but
yeah,
people are just being programmed, and we're just constantly kind of believing the mainstream a lot of the time. But I think more and more people are beginning to see through things. But there's so many layers to this onion. There's just so many, you know. And where do you start?
We're peeling them back. We're peeling them back. I think more and more people now are turning off to mainstream. That's obvious. Mm-hmm. That's obvious by comments I'm seeing on Facebook, or should I say, my wife sees on Facebook. She tells me what she sees, you know, and she says the wake up call is really getting out there. People are questioning everything there, and especially the immigration.
I think that's happening to a degree. And of course, you know, I recently we've heard talk on the mainstream of fake news. And I recently saw a trailer for BBC News, and it was aimed at people in their 20s and 30s. And I wondered what this trailer was when it came on between programs. And it was two girls flicking through their phones outside, a bar or a pub or something, and they're having some conversation. And then the question comes up, well, what's real and what's not real and blah, blah, blah. And I was thinking, oh, this is not some new sort of trashy TV series they're putting on, is it? And then at the end it says, oh, you know, you just come to BBC News and we'll show you what's real or something. Yeah. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. They're having to make commercials for BBC News. That means that they are in a bit of trouble.
Yes.
But, you know, what's happening, and I've essentially already given examples of this in our discussion tonight, really, is that in some ways the internet is great, but in others it's not so great because they just control it differently. They control the mainstream more easily, really, because, you know, it's run by a smaller number of people and a small number of groups of people with their own vested interests. The internet's not like that, but all they need to do to control the internet is just generate noise. It doesn't really matter what it is, whether it's sensible noise or implausible noise or plausible noise. Just generate as much noise as you can. And that pretty much hampers people's progress enough, you know, most of the time. And that's what they've been doing. And, you know, you look at JTRIG, for example, which lays out the strategies for this particular type of noise creation. They know human psychology. They know how the internet works. They invented the internet. They know, you know, they know what each of us looks at. They know all the emails that I've sent, you know, they know what I'm like, they know what my family's like, they know everything, you know. So they can control that and manipulate that at will, really, I think, you know.
Which shows they've got the press in their pocket.
Yeah, and the internet as well, you know.
And the internet, but
pretty much.
Yeah. Well, they're controlling it now.
You just look at the alternative media now, a lot of it's a joke.
Yeah,
really,
yeah.
You know?
But...
Yeah.
But I did notice last week, Brian, when I sat down in front of it waiting for footy to start, and we're doing well in that, aren't we? I saw an ad there, and they're advertising for Facebook. They must be in trouble if Facebook needs to advertise.
I think that is interesting. I didn't know they'd advertise.
Yeah,
Facebook.
I've seen it last week, Andrew. Well, it was Saturday. Yeah, I just, what's this? Facebook are advertising? They're advertising Facebook, so... You know, I think they're having their problems. We're definitely putting the pressure on. I've always thought this is going to be a big year, and it is. It's turning out that way. We never even mentioned, and time's running out on us, good grief. We've not even mentioned about what really got it for me, Andrew, was Van Halen's Comet.
Sorry, which one?
Van Halen's Comet. Is that the correct term?
What do you mean? Which comet?
On the moon. Going around the moon, there's a radiation belt.
Oh, no, yeah.
The Van Allen
belt. Van Allen belt, yeah.
Belt, I beg your pardon.
Yeah, it's around the Earth.
Yeah, the radiation, yeah, sorry, we didn't talk about that. And there is, yeah, it's kind of, this goes backwards and forwards on this issue because, again, people say, yeah, the radiation belts were lethal. But then for example, it was quite funny because if you, Van Allen did indeed discover the Van Allen zones or the Van Allen belts in, I think, 1962, was it? Or 63, 62. And what they did was they had this satellite which was launched by Werner von Braun, the German Nazi rocket scientist, and they put a Geiger counter in this little capsule that there was on top of the rocket. They sent it up, and they had a radio in the capsule which had a, you know, an audio transmission, a microphone, so they could pick up the count from this Geiger counter clicking off in this thing, and that's how they discovered this radiation when it went through these zones. But then when Van Allen was challenged about this some years after the Apollo landed, he said, well, how did they get through this dangerous radiation that you described in your research paper in the 1960s? He says, oh, well, I must have been wrong because they went to the moon and back, so there mustn't have been as bad a radiation as I thought there was. So people will cite that as being, academics will cite that as being proof that the radiation wasn't as bad. But then it goes back the other way because you'll get, there was a video released, I think, in about 2015, where they were trying to reboot the Apollo program under the guise of this Orion program. And they said, oh, we need to have this robust capsule which will carry people to Mars, you know, and before we do that, we've got to make sure that you can keep out the radiation, you know, and we need a material that will keep out the radiation, you know. And this created a stir, of course, because people were saying, well, surely you did that in the 1960s, didn't you? And that is also very strange. And then you find out, for example, that the Smithsonian had to give this Orion program a sample of the Apollo capsule heat shield in 2008 because they'd lost the formula for the heat shield from the original craft, apparently, for the material they used. So, there's some crazy stuff like that.
Where is it? I've lost it.
I mean, Dave McGowan had a good expression. Dave McGowan was another researcher that some people might be familiar with, sadly passed away. And he described what he called the lost technology of the 60s, which is he had a very wry and dry sort of set of articles called, I think, Wagging in the Moon Doggy, I think. You can find that online. It's quite a good read.
Incredible. So where are you at now then, Andrew, in your research? Is it just promoting this stuff, or are you working on new stuff, or what?
Not particularly new stuff. I've actually just been doing a lot of technical work because I've rebuilt the whole website. So that it now, because the website sort of platform was about 11 years old, so 11 years ago we didn't really have quite as many tablets and mobile phones as we do now. So you know, the web software that runs on there didn't really format the pages very well for mobile devices, and the text would be quite small. So I've now spent several weeks actually upgrading the website. Because my background is actually in IT and software and programming and development, that sort of thing. So I've spent the last couple of weeks doing that, and that's just about ready now. Is ready, basically. But also I've been compiling a lot of the earlier research into book form, and I've actually done in the last just over the last 12 months, I've done four books. Is it four books? Four books on various topics, which you can download for free, which back up everything that I'm saying. The last one that I did, which I mentioned earlier, was the Finding the Secret Space Program. That's got 700 references in it. So, people can check that out. You can download the PDF for free, or they can get Kindle versions for about £5 or something, and paperback for about 11 or 12 quid. I encourage people to download those. Read them through, see what you think, get back to me with any questions or feedback you might have, and I'd be very happy to hear from you on those. I'm not particularly actively researching anything, new at the moment. It's really, I suppose, been a question of consolidation, you might say, for me in the last year.
Well, you did mention the Holo hoax earlier on. You obviously know about that. and World War II. You mentioned the Holocaust, or Holocaust, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
You mentioned that earlier on, and you're obviously aware of that. And I don't know what other things you found out about World War II, which I always found the most fascinating subject of all. That just blew me away, you know. So you're obviously aware of all this stuff. The Holocaust.
Well, some of it, yeah. I mean, I'm not much of a historian for World War II. You know, I mean, I've covered a little bit about the paperclip conspiracy, which is where they brought the Nazi scientists over to the US.
Yeah.
That, I think, is, you know, that obviously went wider than the NASA program, and that's pretty widely known about. And, you know, a lot of Nazi scientists were involved in early work on the MK Ultra program and the CIA and stuff like that. I haven't written about that particularly, but I know that Neil Sanders has written quite a bit about that, and there's other books, I think, by Walter Bauart and a few others that people can read about. So yeah, there's definitely sort of this Nazi Germany connection to the US, current US power structure, you know, and things like that.
Stunning. What say you, Browser? Stunning.
Yeah.
That's some really very...
Obviously, you do a lot of work with Richard D. Hall as well. Well, you were doing. I saw you on a lot of YouTube videos with him.
Yeah, I mean, you know...
Discussing things like, you know, I saw you did some very interesting one on Jill Dambo, the English, the TV presenter, and Madeleine McCann case and all that. That's all very interesting stuff too.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. Richard's research is very sort of similarly based to mine. We try and, you know, Richard's very, very good in many areas, and he's also done, you know, he's basically worn out a lot more shoe leather than I have. You know, I pretty much describe myself as a mostly, not exclusively, but mostly an armchair researcher, whereas Richard, you know, he's knocked on doors, you know, interviewed police. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, what he's done is absolutely brilliant. You know, he really sets a shining example of how
he's
things
a
should
true,
be done.
Real independent kind of journalist who gets out there and
asks
the
questions. Yes,
the hard questions too, you know. And
he does.
He comes up with very interesting scenarios too, you know. And, I have to give him credit for that, you know. And
absolutely.
Yeah, that whole Madeleine McCann case is what a can of worms that is. And the Jill Dambo one as well, I thought that was a very interesting documentary did on that whole thing, because I wasn't really aware of all of that, but when I look into the whole behind the scenes scenario of what was going on at the time, and I remember it because I was living in England at the time, I remember those things happening. And it was just but you know, connecting the dots, and jeez, wow.
I mean, you know, this is an example. I mean, if you look at, for example, the Jill Dano case, and you know how Richard brings in the David Copeland nail bombing and all of that. And I'd never heard of that connection. And you know, actually, I was talking to Richard while he was developing that documentary, and he was, you know, he was a bit concerned for his own safety at times, you know, for good reason. But there's an example of similar to what I was saying about the energy connection to 9/11. When you actually dig down deep into the evidence, you end up in a place and finding things out which you didn't expect to find, because, you know, you think, well, why hasn't anybody else talked about this? And Richard essentially with that case was saying, why isn't anybody else talking about the David Copeland bombing? You know, and I'm saying, why isn't anybody else talking about cold fusion and 9/11 almost? You know, it's a similar type of thing, because if you follow the evidence and you keep going after it in it with a sincerity and open mind and willing to correct your mistakes, you will find the truth, and it will probably not be like you thought it was, you know.
Absolutely. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a fascinating show. I've certainly learned a few things about 9/11 and the moon landings. It's really interesting stuff. Thank you so much for coming on, my friend.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
It's been a great show. I really enjoyed it. Okay, folks, thank you so much, guys, for popping in. There's to all the people in the chat room, thanks so much for joining us. You know how much we appreciate you. We'll be back again next week. I'm not quite sure what we've got sorted out yet. But for now, good night from Browser, Andrew, and myself.
Bye.
And we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening, folks. Have a great week. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.